GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1458, January 24, 2011.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Wilmer, Texas. I have been here, I guess since Wednesday evening. If I've got my days right, I delivered the load in Waxahachie, Texas. And then I came to the Wilmer terminal, company terminal, to get my truck worked on. So I signed it into the shop, and then they came out Thursday. There was a guy that came out and did some diagnosis or whatever. He took the truck into the shop for 2 or 3 hours and did some diagnosis work, and I don't think he fixed anything. I don't know why he did that, but anyway, I don't know if he accomplished anything by doing that, but in any case, put me back out in the waiting line. And then someone finally came out later, I guess it was later in the afternoon or maybe even towards evening. I guess it was evening, and came and got the truck and put it in the shop again. And then late in the evening, they told me that they had done everything that they could, and then they sent me to the Dallas, there's a Dallas Freightliner dealership. Huge place. It looks pretty new. I don't know how long it's been open there, but it's in the south part of, it's in South Dallas along Interstate 20 behind the TA truck stop. I think it's at exit 472 off of I-20. There's a Flying J and a Blue Beacon at that exit and what have you. But in any case, there's this huge Freightliner / Western Star dealership. And so they sent me over there. So that's where I signed in and went over there. I guess that would have been Thursday evening. Signed in and told them that, they sent me over there to replace, they were going to replace an EGR valve. Well, so then Friday, so I spent the night there after I signed in. I spent the night parked on their property. And so then, or I guess it was around 11 a.m. or something like that, they called me Friday morning, even though because I'd just gotten out of bed not maybe an hour before that. But anyway, they called me and told me, we're ready to bring your truck in the shop. And so I gave them the truck, and so they began working on it. And so they had really a nice lounge in there. They have a really, really super nice, that's the nicest truck dealership I've ever seen, bar none. They have Wi-Fi and all these tables and a big screen TV and theater seating for drivers to watch television if they want to, and then a separate break room. And so it's a very nice facility. But in any case, I took one of my computers in there, and I was doing some work for Geek News Central. I was writing some, preparing some articles for their CES video postings. And so I was working on that. And so I guess around 5:30, I decided, I'll check with these people and see what's going on with my truck. Well, it turns out that they were waiting on a part, and they hadn't bothered to tell me, but they were waiting on a part. And so I was going to have to spend the night, and you know, their truck was in the shop. It was inside their shop, my truck was. So I called my company, and you know, after, you know, I finally, you know, kind of a long story made short, they finally got to the right person, and in the breakdown department, explained my situation, and then they authorized a motel. And so they told me, you know, go to this motel. It's at the same exit, but it's on the other side of the freeway from where that Freightliner dealership is, a Ramada Limited. And so it was about 4/10 of a mile away, according to Google Maps on my phone. So the motel didn't have a shuttle because their shuttle stopped at 5 p.m., and it was about 7:30 at that point. So, and the Freightliner dealership didn't have anybody to drive me over there. So I just kind of gathered up, as you know, my computers and minimum amount of other stuff, and went ahead and walked over there. And it wasn't that bad of a walk, because I was able to kind of cut through the TA, and it knocked some of the distance off. So it wasn't, you know, probably, it was still 4/10 of a mile probably, but not that bad. So in any case, I walked over there and checked into the motel, and then, so that's where I spent the night at, in that Ramada Limited. And that, it actually turned out to be a rather nice motel. You know, it's kind of ironic. You look at the stuff that's right around that exit, and everything looks great. You know, everything looks new and, you know, great, good looking. but there was in front of that motel, there's the Shell station that has a Jack in the Box in one side. You know, it's kind of integrated together. And place looks great, you know, new looking, looks great. But so I decided I'd just walk into the, you know, after I checked into the motel, I went into the Jack in the Box to get something to eat, and so I decided I'd just eat it right there. And so while I was there, I was there was some guy came in and grabbed a handful of straws from their stash of straws next to the self-service beverages there in that Jack in the Box, and he, you know, kind of stuck them in his pocket and went out and got he was a passenger in a car. And then, you know, and then a few minutes later, some guy came, you know, there were these people came, and this guy came and asked me for a dollar, and I said, sorry, no money. So, you know, and so he, you know, went on about his business. But I kind of sat there for a while as I ate, and a little while afterwards, kind of watching these people come and go, and it became very obvious. Now, of course, I already knew that South Dallas is a bad neighborhood, but it became very obvious all the people, the vast majority of the people frequenting this Shell station and the Jack in the Box were probably on welfare, you know, really, you know, they all had nice cars and so on and so forth, but these people, I don't know, they're just, I wouldn't want to live in that area, you know, quite frankly. So, there was this one kid, I call him a kid, he was a guy. And I swear, you know, he was making a fashion statement. He had his pants were so low that I swear he had some kind of, you know, he had something on underneath him, so he wasn't exposing his rear end or his private parts. But I swear he had his pants, he had a belt on, and he had his pants so, you know, kind of almost down to his knees. And he could barely walk. He's, you know, it caused him to not even be able to walk right. But, you know, he's making a fashion statement that he had low pants. And, I was thinking about that. These people are defective. There's something wrong with them. You know, what is it about our society that has caused, and these were, you know, I'll be honest, these were sort of ghetto welfare type of people. What is it that has caused these people to end up, they're defective people. You know, it's not just that it's a style, a fashion statement, or anything else. These people are, there's something wrong with them. And there's something in our society that has produced that. There's some sort of, you know, it has created, they're really defective people. What are they good for? You know, it would be sort of like, you know, if you scale that back to an individual, which, you know, you can, a society, you know, you can look at society as a giant individual, sort of as a collective individual, but you can scale that back because it's all the same principles are involved, you know, in a society that are, it's the same principles that are involved in an individual and when an individual is dysfunctional. You can look at that as, you know, you might look at that, those people as sort of like, you know, the fat that you accumulate when you eat too much. Or you can look at that as sort of the defective, the cells in your body that are sort of rendered at war with each other. Because you as the sort of the wicked ego king, sort of end up abusing different parts of your body and causing a war between, let's say you cause a war between your immune system versus other parts of your body. You know, you have an autoimmune disease. Well, how does that happen? How, you know, I think my belief is that autoimmune diseases are caused primarily by the sort of this wicked ego king that inhabits the body that runs the place, and that's kind of what's happened to our society. Another way to look at that is that our society is now possessed. It's kind of like you know, an individual can be possessed. I believe that to varying degrees we're all possessed. You know, in the classic religious sense, where, you know, that we are sort of possessed by, you know, by sort of outside influences, and end up doing things that are not to our benefit, and yet we can't stop ourselves. We're slaves. We're slaves. Basically, we're slaves of evil. But there are entities that, and I think they are real entities that actually possess people to varying degrees. With many of us, it may not be as much, but with others, it's, you know, it's much more pronounced. And so I believe that the same thing happens on a mass scale. But I don't know. It's really sad that we've got people that have been in our society that are really useless. They're defective. You know, and what's going to happen to them? You know, what's going to happen to the society? How long can it go on like this? So, anyway, I've got a couple of pieces of audio. Now, the first one I'm going to play is Ayn Rand, and it's about 4 minutes and 10 seconds, and from what I read, it was her last speech she gave in 1981. It was the last public speech that she gave, and it was in front of a group of businessmen, and she's talking about sort of, you know, businessmen sort of being self-destructive, and she's kind of talking about how they are, you know, even in 1981, they were already on the defensive and sort of half-believe, you know, wanting to make friends with all the wrong people. And so anyway, here is, of course, that was right after the Carter administration as well. So here's Ayn Rand, this is from 1981.
I shall start by asking you a question on a borrowed premise. What human occupation is the most useful socially? The borrowed premise is the concept of social usefulness. It is not part of my philosophy to evaluate things by a social standard. But this is the predominant standard of value today, and sometimes it can be very enlightening to adopt the enemy's standard. So let us borrow the notion of social concern for just a little while, just long enough to answer the question, what human occupation is the most useful socially? Since man's basic tool of survival is his mind, the most crucially important occupation is the discovery of knowledge, that is, the occupation of scientists. But scientists are not concerned with society, with social issues, or with other men. Scientists are essentially loners. They pursue knowledge for the sake of knowledge. A great many scientific discoveries and technological discoveries were known before the Industrial Revolution and did not affect human existence. The steam engine, for instance, was known in ancient Greece, but knowledge of that sort remained an exclusive concern that lived and died with the scientists, and for century after century had no connection to the lives of the rest of mankind. Now suppose that a group of men decided to make it their job to bring the results of the achievements of science within the reach of men, to apply scientific knowledge to the improvement of man's life on Earth. Wouldn't such men be the greatest social benefactors as they have been since the Industrial Revolution? Shouldn't the socially concerned humanitarians, those who hold social usefulness as their highest value, regard such men as heroes? If I say no, such men are not regarded as heroes today. They are the most hated, blamed, denounced men in the humanitarian society. Would you believe me? Or would you think that I'm inventing some sort of irrational fiction? And would you say that something is wrong, terribly wrong, in such a society? But this isn't all. There is something much worse. It isn't merely the fact that these heroic men are the victim of an unspeakable injustice. It is the fact that they are first to perpetuate the injustice against themselves, that they adopt a public stance of perpetual apology and universal appeasement, proclaiming themselves guilty of an unspecified evil, begging the forgiveness of every two-bit intellectual, every unskilled laborer, every unemployed politician. No, this is not fiction. That country is the United States of America today. That self-destroying group of men is you, the American businessman. When I say you, I mean the group as a whole. I accept the tenet that present company is accepted. However, if any of you find a shoe that fits, wear it with my compliments.
Okay, so that was Ayn Rand. That was supposedly the last public speech that she gave. That was in 1981, and she was speaking in front of a group of businessmen. You know, so basically what she was saying was that, you know, she was saying that the businessmen were humanitarians, and they were bringing scientific discoveries to the everyday person, and, you know, to make life better. And but yet they're vilified, and they even vilify themselves, and you know, they're trying to be accepted. Now, the reason that people, of course, want to be accepted, and this is the part that's missing from Ayn Rand's philosophy, the reason people want to be accepted is because all you have to do to want to be accepted is resent. All you have to do to want to be accepted is somebody calls you a name, you know, tells you you're fat, your mother wears army boots, whatever it is, or you're evil, or you're destroying the planet, or you're abusing people, you're exploiting the workers, or whatever it is. All you have to do is get upset with that. All you have to do is resent it. Resentment is the key. You know, kind of resentment being the sin. Resentment, you play God in your own mind, wishing someone dead because they upset you in a resentful way. Resentment is the mistake. You resent, and then all of a sudden, you are a slave. You become what you hate. You are whatever you hate becomes your God. And that's what literally makes you care. I hear people say, oh, I'm not going to care anymore. I'm not going to care about this anymore. I'm not going to care about that anymore. Poppycock. You can't just simply decide I'm not going to care. That's ridiculous. I hear people say that all the time. You hear people say it, even down in families, you'll hear someone say, oh, I don't care what my mother thinks, or I'm not going to care anymore what other people think, or what I'm not going to care what my friends think. It's not your, as long as you resent, it's not your prerogative to decide whether you're going to care or not. You will care. As long as you resent, as long as you won't look at yourself, because that's the key to getting rid of the resentment. If you're not even aware, you're not even aware of it, how are you going to, that's not an excuse. Just because you're not, and resentment is interesting because you resent, and packaged with resentment is denial. And so you've got this denial mechanism is packaged right with it, so you're not even aware that it's there. Oftentimes people aren't aware that they resent. You know, they'll say, oh, I love my parents, I love my mother, I love my dad. And it's obvious that they hate them at the same time. It's obvious to other people, but they can't see it themselves. And so resentment is what causes people to care. And so that's all you have to do. If you want to take people over, flipping it around, if you really want to be evil and you have no conscience, all you have to do is just browbeat people, call them names, come up with the vilest thing that you can call people and just, continually pummel them with it and hone in on the people that seem especially vulnerable to it, and you can convert them to your way of thinking. Because they're slaves. All who sin are slaves. They resent you. They'll have to think the way you want them to. Now, if you can do that, there are people that are able to do that because they, for whatever reason, they have no conscience. There are people that can do that. And, you want to blame them. Well, for your vulnerability, well, sorry, it doesn't work that way. It would be like a sort of you trying to blame germs because the piece of meat that you lay out on the counter eventually will rot. If you just lay it out there and you don't do anything with it, it's going to rot. Well, are you going to blame the germs? Or are you going to blame the fact that you didn't properly refrigerate it to try to preserve it, to freeze it or whatever? So at the same time, there are people that are waiting to take over the world. They're waiting to take you over. They're waiting to run your life, to be your slave master. And all you have to do to, it's your fault that, you're the problem is the resentment. The resentment is the problem. And people don't want, they have a way of not seeing that. They want to blame external things. It's not my fault that I got took, basically. It's not my fault that I can't control myself. it's not my fault that that I'm a criminal, basically, is you know, when you want to take it to an extreme. It's other people's fault. No, it's your fault. And the problem is resentment. The problem is then being proud of, you know, going into denial and being proud of what resentment has turned you into, being proud of your sin. You know, and that's why do you think we have pride marches? You know, like abortion pride and God knows what other types of pride marches there are. It's because people are in denial and they want to see wrong as right and right as wrong. So I've got another clip here, and I don't know that I've played this before. I may have. I've had this clip for a while. It's George Soros, and he's being, you know, the title of this is The Bubble of American Supremacy, and he's being interviewed at some college by the, you know, this liberal-looking guy that it looks like a good stiff wind would blow the guy over that's doing the interviewing. But and this is kind of long and drawn out. It goes on for 28 minutes and 9 seconds. But it's very interesting to kind of listen to George Soros' reasoning. And so I'm probably going to end up doing a stop-start on this. But in any case, here's George Soros being interviewed somewhere or other.
Let me start by asking you, if you had grown up in this country rather than in Europe at the time that you did, living through both the Nazis and the beginning of the Eastern Bloc and communism, how do you think your political views might be different today?
Well, I really can't answer that question because it didn't happen.
Well, speculate.
I think that in some ways I'm more sensitive to certain developments than I might be if I'd grown up in this country. You know, when I hear President Bush say that those who are not supporting me are with the terrorists, or when Ashcroft at the USA Patriot Act said that those who oppose the Patriot Act are giving aid and comfort to terrorists, I hear alarm bells. Because it does remind me of this kind of either you are with us or you are against us, that you have got to suspend your critical faculties. And
well, let me interrupt. Now, of course, this was recorded probably when Bush was still president, but George Soros is a well-known liberal. He's funding. He's the major funding source behind MoveOn.org, so on and so forth. And he is behind Obama. I really believe that he's kind of the puppet master behind Barack Obama, or at least one of them, probably the major Mr. Big behind Obama, kind of pulling the strings, because Obama is a puppet. But here he is talking about, oh, you know, Bush is saying, you know, if you're not with us, then you're against us. If you're not in favor of us, you're with the terrorists. Well, here's a case of projection, because that is exactly what the left does, and they're doing it right now. You know, if you don't agree with what the left's goals, if you don't agree. You want to repeal Obamacare, for example, then you're not valid. You're some kind of extreme kook. You're a terrorist in a way. You're racist. You're awful. There's something wrong with you. How could you oppose us? There has to be something wrong with you if you oppose our liberal agenda. You know, our liberal goals. And so they do this. They accuse other people of what they do. They're very good at that. Of course, Karl Marx wrote it down in the book, but people do it naturally. You see parents do that with their kids constantly. And you see people doing that all the time, accuse others of what you do. And anyway, let's go ahead and go on. But there's hypocrisy, you know, right off the bat.
And be patriotic. And that, I think, is a threat to an open society, because an open society depends very, very fundamentally on open discussion and a critical attitude.
Okay, so let's have a critical attitude. I've got a critical attitude. I don't want nationalized health care. I don't want a giant welfare state. I don't want high taxes. I want lower taxes. I want smaller government. We want to shut these people up. Let's bring back the fairness doctrine and shut people up. We don't want, our mainstream media is losing viewers. Let's shut people up. The newspapers are losing viewers or readers. Let's shut down the alternative. Now there's an attack. There's this massive attack that's going on with against cell phones and people texting and being on the smartphones. I'm starting to see articles about these two-bit intellectuals that are writing these articles about how bad it is for society that people are on the internet all the time and they've got their cell phones and they're communicating. How terrible that is.
When you came to this country after being educated in England, what was in your mind? What did you expect to find? What did you want to find? And have you found it?
Here.
Here.
I chose the West because I sought for freedom. But to be frank, I came to America to make money.
Well, introduces a point which I myself wanted to raise. I mean, on the one hand, you are a man who has been quite accomplished in this task of making money. And on the other hand, you've been extremely accomplished in giving it away. And you, in one book that I read that you wrote, I think your last one, you noted that Henry Kissinger said that nations have no principles, only interest, and you are sometimes said to have principles and no interest. But indeed, there is quite a contradiction between making money and philanthropy and political involvement such as you engage in. How do you see these two things as reconciling in your mind?
Well, first of all, in order to give money away, you've got to make it first, unless you inherit it. So I don't see any contradiction. Let's say I was concerned about the world before I became a billionaire. So when I became rich, and I actually set up my foundation long before I became a billionaire, that goes back to 1979, when my investment fund reached $100 million and my wealth was about $20 million. And actually making money was a tremendous strain, very risky, very strenuous. And I wondered, why do I do it? And that's when I set up a foundation. Mm-hmm. So I think that, the two things, making money and giving money away, are all inspired by the same sort of set of ideas.
Well, that's interesting. Let me ask you to elaborate a little on that. I mean, I would imagine, well, let me ask you, do you enjoy the making of the money as much as you do the activities that it enables you to engage in once it's there?
Well, I used to enjoy making money a lot, and it's a very exciting activity, it's very challenging. But it didn't give me the kind of satisfaction that I have in giving it away. I mean, I had one particular experience that I sort of referred to when I was under tremendous strain, and I thought that I was going to have a heart attack. And I thought, what a shame to die, making money. And
well, we're glad you did make it.
Now, in the things that I am engaged in, I'm actually willing to put my life at risk, and I think it makes me feel much more complete.
Obviously,
Now, this is interesting. You see, because there are people, and I've said this before, and I think this Soros may be one of them. there are people that the only satisfaction, the only real satisfaction that they have is in tearing people down, tearing other things, you know, things that they perceive as wrong, kind of tearing society down, tearing things down, and that's basically what he's doing. And it's going to become clear as this file goes on, it becomes clear in his mind he thinks he's doing good, but he's looking at the world backwards. Wrong is right, right is wrong.
And we talked about this a little earlier. There it could be said that you, in a way, by entering the world of electoral politics, are an oligarch. Ironically, an oligarch on the Democratic rather than the Republican side. What's the rebuttal to that suggestion?
Well, first of all, I like the philanthropolitic. That's a very good term. You know, there's been a lot of discussion of sort of political donations, and the fact that I had been supporting and continue to support campaign finance reform. Now, I think that my activities are fully in compliance, not only with the letter of the law, but also with the spirit, because the campaign finance was basically designed to deny access to special interests. And these organizations that I...
Yeah, but except him, he's a special interest.
...support. They were there before I started supporting them. They were deliberately not regulated by the campaign finance. And the Federal Election Commission reaffirmed this just recently. In other words, I'm complying with the letter. But I think that the purpose was not to take money out of politics, because that's an impossibility, but to deny special interests access. And if you support these organizations, you get no access. It doesn't get you anything. And because of that, it's very difficult to get support for it. I'm trying to get other people to contribute, and it isn't easy.
Well, you get paid back, I suppose, in political currency, a currency of being a citizen. Do you consider that to be a legitimate...
Well, interest? I'm doing it out of principle. So I think that this is in accordance. Now, nevertheless, I think that in view of the experience with this election, the issue should be re-examined. Is the present regulation good? Is it good to separate, let's say, soft money from the party? Or should, in fact, soft money be allowed to go through the party? And should there be more free access to media? I think that actually giving more free access to media, which does not interfere with the First Amendment, because after all the airwaves are a public good, would be a much better way to reduce the influence of money.
Now, it's interesting. You know, there's this idea that's been perpetuated that the airwaves are for the public good. You know, and that kind of, if you think about that, that sort of, I don't know if Ayn Rand ever talked about that, but that sort of ties in with, if you've read the Atlas Shrugged, and kind of go through the philosophy that she puts forward in that. There's this idea that you're going to do it for the public good. If, for example, this clip that I just played earlier of her, where she's talking about these people, that these social do-gooder types that we're going to do it for the public good. you know, whatever the hell that is. You know, and of course, the people that usually talk about the public good are the types that see wrong as right, right as wrong. And I was thinking about this earlier. You know, who is attracted to being a professor? You know, like this as I say, this guy that's doing this interviewing. If he had to get out in the real world and do a real world job, he probably couldn't do it. A good stiff wind would blow him over. And, you know, why is it that those types of people are attracted to be teachers and to be, you know, in universities and so on and so forth? And, you know, fundamentally, with most of them, quite frankly, there's something wrong with them. And yet, they're the people that end up being teachers, and they're the people that end up controlling education. And of course, our education system has been compromised for a long time. It's run by communists, quite frankly. So I don't know. Anyway, let's go ahead. But this idea that airwaves are for the public good, well, no, they're not. that's like saying that the air itself is for the public good. Well, you know, it just is. You know, the air is the air. That's like saying that other things are that we just have to live are for the public good. Well, you know, I don't know. It's kind of you got to be careful with a concept like that, because then they can kind of come along, these same types of people can come along and say, oh, that's for the public good, you can't make a profit off of it, or that's for the public good, you have to give part of your stuff, your airtime away, for example. Or, you know, and even when, if they do that, they can come along and say, you know, they want to do the same thing with the internet and say, oh, well, if you, you know, for example, they could say, well, if you're going to advocate for Republican side, you have to give equal time to the Democrat side, or you have to advocate for them too, or you have to give it for free or whatever. Or you can't do it, or if you advocate a certain political view, then you have to report that as advocacy, or you have to report it as income, or something. Something twisted. You know, and they'll try to. There are people that want to come along and say, "Oh, well, the internet has to be for the public good." So, I don't know. These are sort of twisted concepts, and twisted minds can kind of twist things, and make wrong seem right and right seem wrong.
In Brazil, for instance, they had elections, and a very large amount of airtime was allocated to the candidates. I think it was a very good system. So I wish that would be considered in this country.
Well, that raises the interesting question of whether we in this country don't need some more robust form of public broadcasting, non-commercial broadcasting.
Yes, and NPR, for instance, one of the few institutions left in our media that is really giving good information.
And would you are you inclined to support something like NPR? I mean, do you think it plays that critical role?
Well, I'm not financially supporting NPR, but I support it in principle.
Hypocrite.
Yes, principle and interest. The world is now really intertwined in a way as never before, and global markets, such as they are paramount. Do you think this system has enough integrity to survive?
Well, no, just as he said that, the world is entwined as it never has been before. Well, if you think of a cancerous, let's say you have an individual that has cancer, and the cancer has metastasized, and it's in their brain, and it's in their lungs, and it's in their kidneys, and it's in their liver, and it's kind of all over the place. That's basically what globalization has done. Things have sort of metastasized.
given the weaknesses of sovereign structure and nation states?
No, you have currently some kind of a distortion in globalization, because you've got global markets, but political arrangements remain firmly based on the principle of sovereignty. And because of the greatly increased interdependence, what goes on inside other countries is of vital interest to us and to other, to everybody in the world. So what kind of regime you have in Afghanistan, let's say, has a bearing on our security. And that poses an unsolved problem. What do you do about internal political developments in countries? Because most of the poverty and misery in the world today is due to bad government of one sort or another. Repressive regimes, corrupt regimes, failed states, and so on.
And governments that overprint and overspend.
What do you do about that? And that is a great unsolved problem that we need to address.
Well, talk about that. I mean, what is the right balance between sovereignty on the one hand and internationalism and maybe world government on the other hand, which, as you well know, is a real antichrist for many people in this country and elsewhere in the world?
Well, I think the principle of sovereignty is the prevailing principle, but it is becoming modified because there are some universal principles that begin to limit the concept of absolute sovereignty. So I think if you look at the sovereignty is sort of an anachronistic or a slightly atavistic idea of goes back to where you had kings and subjects and the kings ruled over their subjects. And then in the French Revolution, the king was killed and the people took possession of sovereignty. And that's modernity. That gave rise to the nation state. But the elected government or non-elected governments very often abuse the sovereignty that belong to the people. And in that case, there is a need for the international community to intervene. And that concept needs to be elaborated. It is slowly being developed. There was a report which argued that there is a responsibility to protect, that when the people are abused by their own rulers and human rights are abused, that there is an international responsibility to intervene. That there was a declaration in Warsaw in the year 2000 which established the principle that it is in the interest of all democracies to help the development of democracy in other countries. But this is a principle that is worth that is an empty statement like so many principles. But to breathe life into it, I think, is what is now needed. So I think this is the direction that we ought to move, and I think the United States ought to lead that movement. However, this administration has led us in a very different direction, because they act on the belief that international relations are relations of power and not law, that international law merely serves to legitimize whatever power has accomplished. And since we are so powerful, we have a right to impose our will on the world. And that, I think, is tremendously dangerous, Because in fact we are very powerful. And this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the most powerful nation on earth is guided by that principle, that's the principle that's going to prevail. And then we are really going back towards a less civilized world.
And do you see any real prospect in the near future that...
See, he sees that backwards, because he's thinking, oh, you know, the liberal thinking is that, you know, the United States is unjust and we're consuming too much, too many resources and so on and so forth, and it's just not fair. And you know, but you know, rather than elevating the people in the rest of the world, these people always want to knock everybody down. So instead of elevating and making, you know, making as many people in the world, elevating them as high as possible, they want to knock everybody down and then make everybody equally miserable, and, you know, of course, excluding themselves, and they get to preside over the misery. And that's the only thing that the only happiness that these sorts of people have is presiding over people that are worse than they are. And then, you know, so that's really what drives them to knock things down. There are people, again, there are people that the only joy, if you want to use that word, that they have out of life is destroying other people. You know, knocking, you see that in families all the time. You see, you know, people knocking each other down, you know, for various reasons. And that's, but, you know, and in the case of George Soros, he's got the money to sort of exercise his character flaw, and his particular character flaw revolves around his political, you know, these warped political views that he has. And, you know, so he's, but then again, you know, who are you going to blame? How's it possible for somebody like George Soros to do what he does? It's because there are so many people, particularly in the United States, there are so many people that are, our morals have, you know, gone south, basically. Our morals are corrupted, to the point where someone like this can just buy and sell and gain power and you know, be able to buy and sell people's loyalties.
Americans will understand this world as you would like to see it. And moreover, I might ask, why is it that something that is so self-evident to you and to many others is not self-evident at all to so many?
Well, I very much hope that we are a democracy. And we can judge our leadership in the elections. And that's why I'm arguing that we have to reject what this administration has done, particularly after September 11. So this Bush doctrine, which basically is built on two pillars. One, that we must have maintain absolute military superiority globally and in every region of the world. And second, that we have the right for preemptive military action. If you combine these two, you see, you really have a world of two levels of sovereignty. United States, whose sovereignty is sacrosanct, and the sovereignty of the rest of the world, which is subject to the Bush doctrine, of preemptive action. It's like Orwell's Animal Farm. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Mm-hmm. That is, I think, where we have gone wrong. And if we now reject that, then I think we can undo, we can treat the events of the last few years as an aberration, and we can resume our place in the world. if we endorse it, because after all, Bush was not elected on that doctrine. He was elected on the basis of a humble foreign policy. Now, if we now endorse this new doctrine, then we have to take the consequences. So we have a real choice, and it is clear to me what the choice should be, and I think it's tremendously important, and that's why I have made this sort of my project for this year, to try to...
And how do you analyze the wellsprings of this political fundamentalism, which in many ways, as you pointed out, and by the way, George has written a wonderful book, The Bubble of American Supremacy, which is a very concise and I think nicely argued alternative vision of how America can be in the world. But where do you think this sort of fundamentalist impulse that has now bled over into politics arises from? And is it more extreme now, in your experience, at this point in our history than, say, 20, 30, 40 years ago?
I definitely think that it has become dominant and it has been carried too far. Now, you have various kinds of fundamentalism sort of allied in the present government. You've got what I called market fundamentalism. In other words, a belief in free enterprise without constraint, because you can rely on the invisible hand of the market to bring about equilibrium. So that was market fundamentalism, and I was a critic of that. But then you have got religious fundamentalism, and now you have this belief in American supremacy. And that, I think, is this is sort of the neoconservative, the project for a new American century that was formed in 1997, and then advocated invading Iraq in 1998. That, I think, is a dangerous new addition. Because as long as you advocate competition, unrestrained competition in the commercial field, that's one thing. But if you advocate competition in the military field, that, I think, is very dangerous for world peace.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, we end up with fundamentalism counterposed to fundamentalism.
Well, you have a sort of an unholy alliance between these various fundamentalist forces. You also, of course, have a degree of continuity in the government, because not everybody in the government is of this ilk, and you certainly in the State Department you basically have continuity. And a much less ideological view of the world. It's around the Defense Department that this particular school of thought is concentrated, and that's where I think the real danger comes from.
Now, we know you're really no supporter of Bush, but let me ask you before we get to the Bush question, what's right about what Bush has done?
I was, for instance, and remain a supporter of the Millennium Challenge account, he's done quite well on fighting AIDS, even contributing to the Global Fund for AIDS. So it's not all bad. It's only that there is a sort of a group within the government that gained the upper hand after September 11. And because the critical process was suspended, they could get their way. And this is what led to the invasion of Iraq the way it happened.
And you don't think it's correctable, given the elasticity of the current administration? The only remedy, as far as you're concerned, is to see them voted out?
No, I think it is being corrected to some extent. I mean, because the Bush administration has turned to the United Nations to assist in creating a democratic government in Iraq, because it hasn't got the legitimacy to do it, because we are an occupying power in Iraq, and no government that we install would be a legitimate government. And now, with the elections looming and the need to get Iraq off the front burner, the Bush administration actually is correcting its mistakes and is turning to the United Nations. And I think it could actually, it will be a very painful process because of the tremendous ethnic tensions. And if you have a democratic solution which gives the Shias their rights, the Sunnis are going to resist it and engage in terrorism, or rather guerrilla warfare. So there's going to be a lot of trouble yet. But there is a way out, I hope it will be successful.
You know, it strikes me, though, as the world can ill afford to have American presidents have such a steep and repetitive learning curve. When Robert McNamara was here, I asked him at dinner, quite frankly, I asked him if he thought he would be a better leader now than when he was Secretary of Defense, and he said, by all means.
Yes.
And then I said, do you think we can afford to give people like you the opportunity to learn the lesson of a failed war in order to revise your view of the world? And he thought for a while, and he just shook his head, and he didn't answer. But this seems to me is the challenge.
Well, you can't avoid it. This is one of the, let's say, the penalties of democracy and changes in government. I remember very well when Kennedy became president and met with Khrushchev in Vienna, and Khrushchev sized him up and said, this is a naive guy and I can do what I want. And then imposed division of Berlin, and we had the Berlin crisis. So Kennedy also had to learn the hard way. I think this is part of the
perfectibility of man.
Well, and then if you were to remain, let's say, in England, where you have a different system, and Margaret Thatcher remained Prime Minister for 10 years, she got carried away by her success and eventually overstepped the mark also. So, I mean, there is no perfect government. So we are always bound to make mistakes.
So at heart, you are fairly still a true believer in the democratic process, given some ups and downs, that it ultimately can clarify itself.
Well, it's the, as Churchill said.
Yes.
tell
everybody what Churchill said.
No, well, you know, that it's the worst political system except all the others. in the end, an open society depends on a well-informed electorate that is, let's say, exercises reasonable judgment. And in that respect, there is, our open society is now endangered in ways that it wasn't before. Because there is, and this is appropriate to a school of journalism, there is a kind of an Orwellian truth machine operating in this country, And it's a very strange phenomenon, because, of course, it's not new that information and facts should be twisted. They always are in the political process. And Orwell saw the danger of propaganda 50 years ago. But when he was talking, when he wrote 1984, he was referring to a ministry of truth in a country or in an imaginary country where the ministry controlled all the media. Here we do have free media, and nevertheless, there is a way to twist facts and move opinion.
Now, will you all join me in thanking George for coming here? Thank you, George.
Okay, so I mean, there towards the end, he sounds kind of reasonable. And, you know, and he has some valid observations. Our media, you know, ostensibly we're legally free for the most part to say what we want. You know, there are people that want to get rid of that. The problem is that people that are engaged in the media, especially the mainstream media, they are slaves. They're enslaved. And that's why they kind of end up marching in lockstep so much. And that's why they're, you know, they are liberal. And for the most part. And the reason that they are is because they're all kind of brainwashed. And they're all sort of, they all end up kind of marching in lockstep. And, of course, in a free market, there, you know, we do have the new media, we do have the internet, we do have alternative media, and that's why the newspaper, that's one of the reasons the newspaper readership's going down, that's one of the reasons why, the main reason why the television viewership for all these news programs is going down, is because people are turning it off. And, you know, the other thing that I was thinking about, none of us are perfect. We all have our character flaws, as I've said many times. And because of that, we're all, to varying degrees, we are all suggestible. And so it's kind of dangerous. There's a lot of people that end up kind of getting bamboozled, and they think, oh, we have to be informed. They've kind of bought into the old axiom, well, you need to be informed, you know, so you want to watch the news and so on and so forth, and then you're informed. Well, the problem is you end up getting brainwashed by that. Because one way to look at it, if you've got character flaws, and we all do, means to one degree or another you're suggestible. Whether you want to be or not, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter whether you want to be suggestible or not. That's irrelevant. You are suggestible, and you will take suggestion from other people. In other words, you're brainwashable. You can think, oh, I'm not going to care, or I know about, you know, how the media is trying to twist me and turn me and make me think a certain way. I know about it, so that nullifies the effect. Oh, no, it doesn't. You're still suggestible. You're still being brainwashed, whether you're aware of it or not. How many people are aware that they engage in behavior that's self-destructive, yet they're under a compulsion to do it anyway, and they do it anyway? So therefore, you know, you have to be very careful about what you expose yourself to in a political sense, or news sense. You have to be very careful because, you know, you can end up getting twisted and brainwashed. And it all goes back to morality and your willingness to look at yourself, you know, because that's the only way you can improve your character flaws. You're there, and you can't improve them. You know, that's really not even right to say it that way. You can't improve your own character flaws. It's not possible. All you can do is have a willingness to look at yourself. And, you know, whatever it is that's showing you, and of course it's God, but whatever it is that's showing you your character flaws is the only thing that can change you. That's the only thing that can straighten you out, and nothing else can. You can't straighten yourself out. That's not possible. You can't improve yourself. You know, so anyway, I didn't really have time to kind of comment on it the way I wanted to do it, you know, doing a stop start. And so if I have played that before, then I've played it again. So the Soros piece. So anyway, probably better be cutting this off. Hope everyone is having a great weekend, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.